Hi, my name is Dr. Barry.
Healthy Minds Alliance is an innovative AmeriCorps program managed by Health 360 that engages AmeriCorps members of all ages and backgrounds to meet critical mental health needs in communities served by their host sites. AmeriCorps members serving with the Healthy Minds Alliance receive a stipend during their 10-month service term, and upon completion of their service term, receive an education award which can be used to repay qualified student loans and to pay current educational expenses at eligible institutions of higher education and training programs. If you're interested in becoming an AmeriCorps member or would like information on how your organization could become a host site, please see our show notes for information on how to apply.
Welcome, current, former, future AmeriCorps service members. My name is Michael, and I will be your host for today's Healthy Minds Alliance podcast. And I'm also currently serving my second term as an AmeriCorps service member. Joining me today is Dr. Barry, a trained and board-certified pediatrician, as well as a general psychiatrist and a child and adolescent psychiatrist based out of Cincinnati. Dr. Barry, welcome to the show.
All right. Well, thank you very much for having me here.
Oh, it's my absolute pleasure to have you. Thank you so much again for being here. So let's start today by getting to know you just a little bit better, both in your working life, but if, you know, really anything you'd like to share.
I'm originally from Detroit, and I moved here to Cincinnati in 2015 for triple board residency and fellowship. I graduated in 2020, and I'm triple boarded in pediatrics, psychiatry, so that's adult psychiatry, and child and adolescent psychiatry. Shortly after graduation, I signed on here at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center as faculty, and I primarily work in the partial hospitalization program. There are two locations, and I'm working with adolescents, so ages 12 mostly through 17, and that's like a mid-level of care, so not as sick kids as inpatient, but not as well as outpatient. So I've been here now for 2 years, and I'm currently the medical director. I am also the triple board associate program director, and I'm the diversity, equity, and inclusion chair of psychiatry. So I am doing a lot of work with kids and adolescents, with mental health, as well as some of the community work with the diversity, equity, and inclusion. And then lastly, I think most relevant to this talk today is I am also doing research on Black youth suicide. And so we are trying to understand and uncover the reason why the suicidal rates in the Black community, specifically adolescents, have doubled over the past 10 to 15 years. The suicidal rates as a whole have increased in the U.S. population, but we've seen a substantial increase in the Black population. So I have a research team that I'm working very closely with, and we're trying to uncover why that's the case, and really excited that we were just awarded a grant. So now we have funding support for it, which is great, because before we were just kind of finding the time to do this on our own, because we're all passionate about this topic. So that's pretty much me in a nutshell. I live in Cincinnati with my dog. Her name is Goldie. I enjoy taking walks with her and hiking. I really love the parks and the outdoorsy sceneries that Cincinnati has to offer.
All right. Well, I'm so thrilled to get a chance to talk with you today. Thank you so much graciously for giving me some of your time. So obviously you've already been in the work for a while. But I do want to take a quick step back. What drew you to this work to begin with? What was it about mental health education, awareness, and treatment that interested you, that brought you into this role?
That's a really good question. So actually, before I went into medical school, I was a nurse's aide at a special care nursery. And so when I entered into medical school, I thought I wanted to practice just as a pediatrician. But as I reflect kind of back on my experiences as a nurse's aide, what I was very interested in was the relationship between the mother and the infant, like the attachment style. And it was more of the relationship that I kind of fell in love with medicine for. I still loved the medical pieces of it as well, but it was also the relationship and understanding that bonding and that attachment. So that I think that sparked that interest in psychiatry. And then when I completed my psychiatry rotation during medical school, I really enjoyed working with people of different mental illnesses. I think that psychiatry is embedded into every single field, and there are no fields that you can work in medicine that you're not having some relationship, some rapport, or that there's not a mind-body connection. And so having the time to sit down and build that rapport with the patients in comparison to, for example, my pediatric component of my residency, our meetings with patients were every 15 minutes. And I never felt like I was able to build that rapport and relationship with the family because I had to quickly complete my physical exam and completely have an assessment and a treatment plan and go on to the next patient. And what I really fell in love with psychiatry was having that time to spend with the patient and the families, build those rapport, and make a difference in that way. And that for me was more fulfilling and more meaningful. So I definitely loved that aspect of psychiatry. And then in my last year of medical school, I completed a one-month rotation of child and adolescent psychiatry. And I've always enjoyed and loved working with children, and I've enjoyed just seeing them develop and grow. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to go into child and adolescent psychiatry at the time or just wanted to move forward with adult psychiatry. But definitely seeing the relationships that children have with their communities, their social environments, their families, and how it can impact development or change the trajectory of the development, that was what interested me the most. And I think that kind of took me full circle back to that first like interest I had of when I was a nurse's aide in the NICU and in the special care nursery of those relationships between the mother and the infant.
So with my role in the AmeriCorps program, I am one of the facilitators for youth mental health first aid. It's like a first aid course dealing with mental health, mental challenges that youth might have. So that's kind of my biggest focus just because that's the one that I teach. But we have courses that are for like children all the way up to adults. We also have special communities. So in your role as a psychiatrist, what do you think the biggest difference between a youth-focused program and an adult is? Is it the challenges they're dealing with? Is it the approach that you would use to interact with the patient or a little bit of both? Or how would you kind of quantify that?
All of the above. So that's okay. A great question. So What we see with child and adolescent psychiatry in comparison to adult psychiatry is the pathology is different most of the time. So I'm seeing a lot more youth and adolescents with depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation, aggression, behavioral outbursts. Whereas with adults, we see some of those symptoms. But more so, we're seeing some of the more advanced stages like schizophrenia or bipolar mania. So the pathology can look a little bit different because with youth and adolescents, it usually is kind of like more of that precursor symptoms that we're seeing. The other difference is that usually children don't bring themselves to see me.
Okay, fair.
It's usually their parents or their teachers, or there's usually some external social figure in their lives that are bringing them to see me because there is something that is impacting their functioning at home or at school or, you know, in their lives to some capacity. And usually it's impacting the parents. And so they're bringing their child in for help because it's a lot to manage. More so with adults, my experience has been, now there have been experiences too with working with adults where the police may be bringing them in or mobile crisis, for example, may be bringing them in to seek treatment. But for the most part, adults are willingly consenting and looking for treatment, and they have different motivations or different reasons. Typically, there is some impact in functioning that they're struggling with, but they usually, not all the time, have the insight to come into the meetings with me, the interview with me, sharing their concerns or their symptoms. Whereas usually with the youth and adolescent population, it's the parent that is sharing, my kid has these X symptoms, and then it's my job to try to uncover where the facts are between what the family is sharing, they're experiencing, as well as what the child is experiencing from their perception, their lens. And then also to understand it from a developmental lens, because it's also looking at, you know, what stage of life are they in? What stage of cognitive functioning are they in? What stage of socialization are they in? Are they regressing from that stage, or have they not been able to progress? And how is wherever stage they're in, how does that compare to peers of their age, of their age group? Are they on the trajectory that they should be? Are they not? And then how do we come up with a treatment plan? So I think why I enjoy the environment I currently work in is at the partial setting, is that we are able to gain three different social contexts of the patient's symptoms. So we're able to observe here in our milieu, in our setting, what we're seeing. We're also able to get the collateral information from the family. We're also able to get the information from the patient. And then we also have a school specialist here that collaborates with the school to understand what is being seen in the school setting. And gathering all of that information can help then uncover what is consistent. Mm-hmm. You know, what is this child consistently struggling with in all of these settings? And it helps us kind of then narrow down, is this a parent-child conflict? Is this sibling conflict? You know, is this only in one setting or is it in multiple? I think the biggest challenge in working with adolescents in comparison to adults is, well, number one, their brains aren't fully developed. So executive functioning and impulsive behaviors, risky behaviors are definitely more so there than with adults. But the biggest challenge I find is getting the families to be on board with their own accountability and responsibility to what they're bringing their child in for. It's really hard to introspectively look at, you know, how a parent is parenting and how that's affecting their child. So it takes a lot of rapport building and feeling that the patients can trust. And that the families can trust, which I know one of the things we're talking about is mental health in the minority communities. And that trust and mistrust is a huge barrier to what I see minority families and communities seeking mental health care. And that's also kind of looking at some of the historical context of the medical system in our country.
Yeah, I wanted to kind of get your perspective on that as well. When you're working with the minority population, you know, what are some of the key differences between that and a general population as far as, you already kind of touched on like getting them to buy into the fact that this is needed and helpful. Beyond that, are there any considerations that you have? Are we seeing different types of issues and challenges amongst different populations or anything else that you would think of note when dealing with the general population versus a minority population?
Yes, I definitely see some differences. I think the first part is that trust is a huge factor. So, someone from a marginalized or minority background feeling that they can trust their healthcare provider They're historically, if you kind of think about the community and who were like the community leaders from a historical context, it was more so like the pastors or maybe church leaders or members, religious leaders. And there's been kind of this narrative, especially in the Black community, that you really should pray about your symptoms, or, you know, you're not praying hard enough, or you're not working hard enough if you're having these symptoms. But there's not really a push or a encouragement of seeking mental health care treatment. And that is because there have been a lot of historical, unfortunate things that have happened, you know, from the Tuskegee experiment, Henrietta Lacks, and you think about the father of gynecology and just all of the historical trauma that have occurred in the community and how it has affected the ability to trust. What I'm seeing now with looking at our research is that we do struggle to enroll more minority people, families and patients and Black patients into our research study. And right now we have, for example, double white participants and we have half of the Black participants. And so I think there is just a fear of, you know, what does this mean? What will happen? Will I be harmed? Will my child be harmed? I don't want my child to be in an experiment or a guinea pig. So there's all of these fears that are rooted in historical accounts. And so I think trust is a big factor of it, and mistrust of the healthcare system in general.
So, yeah, one of the things I've seen, minority populations are usually less likely to seek medical care until it's an emergency. And so they will go to the ER rather than going to get a checkup. Are you seeing similar to that, where a problem gets to a very high level before they are seeking treatment because they kind of are forced to at that later stage?
Yes, exactly. So we are seeing that where, you know, we're more so seeing our minority population in the midst of a crisis, and they're not those as much of the consistent, like, outpatient preventative mental health care treatment. And there could be many socioeconomic factors that are playing into that. There could be a lack of transportation. There could be a lack of, you know, financial ability to make the appointments. There could be, you know, various kind of barriers. Parent working cannot get the child to the appointment, or that there's just a lack of resources in the community. There are not any providers. We are seeing a shortage of providers for mental health as a whole. So it's taking much longer to get into a mental health provider. And so, you know, there could be as long as a 6-month or longer wait list. And, you know, if the family and the patient has already waited until a crisis emerged before seeking help, then they are presenting to the emergency room with multiple complex symptoms and factors. And it certainly is definitely a trend that we see quite often.
So is there, like, what kind of resources would you want people to know that is out there, either maybe local to Cincinnati or, if you know, national? Like, if someone is at home and, like, they don't have the money to pay for it, they don't have time off of work to get there, what resources could we make available to them or educate them about that might help them?
Sure, absolutely. So if they are located in the Cincinnati, greater Cincinnati area, there is PERC, which is the Psychiatric Intake Response Center. And that number, I don't have off the top of my head, but it...
I can find it. I'll put it in the show notes.
Perfect. If someone were to call the General Cincinnati Children's line and ask for the Psychiatric Intake Response Center, they would be able to access that number. It is available 24/7, 365 days a year. And what I like about that resource is that they then look at the area that the patient, the family is located and can then give resources for what is convenient. They can also help with triaging if a crisis does require an in-person evaluation or if the crisis is something that could be safely managed at home. So they can provide in-the-moment guidance on any kind of actual symptoms occurring as well as resources. And, you know, there are definitely lists of resources I can send, but it can just vary based on where the patient lives and then also their insurance. Another good resource is 988. So that is a national suicide hotline that is also always mended and available for discussion about how someone's feeling, how someone's doing. And they are also able to provide crisis intervention or make recommendations for an in-person evaluation. And that number can also provide guidance on where to seek help if needed.
Okay.
So those are the two places I would start if we're talking about a child in need, having a mental health crisis or just needing some resources in the community.
So let's say we have, we're a parent. We have a child in our house that is exhibiting behavior that we think could be symptomatic of a mental health challenge. What would you want that parent, like what is something I could do that doesn't necessarily involve going to a professional or seeking treatment, but what can I do as a parent? Because I have two young boys, 13 and 12, and I'm hyper kind of conscious of them and like when they want to share and they're getting to the age where they're more interested in talking to their friends or their girlfriends than they are me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just like, I'm also looking for tips for myself. Like what should I be looking out for? You know, what is urgently needs help versus just a kid being a kid? What advice would you give to me then, I guess?
Absolutely. So I think communication is key, and you're right. Like as kids kind of age into their adolescence, they are more interested in social interactions with their peers and less with their family. But monitoring their behaviors very closely, keeping that line of communication open as much as possible. And there are certainly ways that one can be creative with that. So some examples could be checking in verbally with that teenager or writing to each other. So one of the things that we utilize here in our program is the concept of a two-way journal, where a teen can write in a journal how they're feeling, how their mood is, how their day was, kind of just whatever comes to mind. Leave it in some random place that the parent knows where to pick it up. The parent then picks it up and writes back to the teenager and puts it back down. And then that way that communication is still occurring. So I think being creative about how that communication can occur. It could be, hey, let's go play a game, let's play a board game, or hey, let's go out and, you know, go shopping, or let's cook together. And that could be a good way of engaging that teen. So just anything that can engage the teen in a way that can get them to communicate. I think also letting them know that you support them, that you're always there for them, that they can always be open and share and be transparent with you, even as hard as it may be. So I think that teen also feeling that support and not feeling very scared and kind of having that open door, you can always come to me and talk to me about anything, no matter how hard it is, kind of policy in the family is really, really helpful. Things to look out for, I would consider those like the warning signs. So any change, any drastic change in behavior, this could look like changes in sleep pattern, excessive sleeping or not having enough sleep, changes in appetite. Going, you know, times without eating or overeating. That could look like increased irritability or snapping or behavioral outbursts. And this wouldn't necessarily be just like kind of being a bit moody one day here or there, but more of like a consistent change in behaviors. That could look like a change in functioning at school. So grades previously were, you know, average grades and they've dropped. Now that teen is failing. it could look like concerns of changes in the social group that the teen is hanging out in. So looking for, you know, are they trying to have riskier behaviors like running away, or are you concerned at all for any substance use? That's certainly something to always be mindful of. So really looking for any apparent changes in behavior that are maybe outside of what you would consider typical, like, teen development. And certainly some of it is normal. Like, it's normal for teens to be curious, or it's normal for them to explore. But once it starts to impact their functioning and they're not able to go to school, or they're not caring to their hygiene, they're not completing their activities of daily living, or they're appearing really sad, withdrawn, depressed, isolating, and then also any kind of indication of suicidal thoughts. They're saying, I just don't want to be around. I just don't want to live. What's the point? And then if they're motivated for things that they typically would be motivated for, interested in. So we expect a teen that would want to hang out with their friends and want to go out, you know, to the movies or wherever with their friends, or want to play on their games if they're not even doing those things that you would expect. Those are the warning signs that let us know. And so I think having that relationship where a teen feels that they can come and talk to an adult, whether that is the parent or an aunt or an uncle or someone, and then the adults and the parents looking out for those warning signs together, those two are going to be those main important factors in being able to identify if there is something emerging. I think it can be difficult with all of the social media influence. So there is definitely an uptake that we've seen in different mental health conditions because of exposures on social media. And I think it's a double-edged sword. I think that increased awareness is great, and that we should be more comfortable to talk about mental health. But I also too worry about some of the teens that I've met with or worked with, and them being exposed to mental health conditions and maybe needing attention or needing, maybe time or love from their family, and not feeling like they're getting it, and looking to other sources to get that. And that could look like more symptoms of mental health. So that is something I see quite commonly here in our environment.
So let's imagine that Dr. Barry has a magic wand, and you can wave it and you can just change something about mental health, education, awareness. What do you think would have the greatest impact? Is it just education and awareness, that people know that this is something that happens, not to be ashamed and to seek treatment? Or is there something else that you think would be like a better critical factor to help improve the lives of the people you work with?
That's a great question. I do agree that awareness is a big piece of it, but also resources, and that resources are available timely, and that they are within reach. So when we think about when crises emerge, and, you know, like what we discussed before, is that there is just a difficult time with patients and families being able to find outpatient providers and get that preventative mental health care. And so what we do see is those crises emerging because of, you know, the lack of resources and the inaccessibility. So I think the awareness is one big piece, but also the resources being available, and that it's available in a timely manner when it counts, so that the patient is at the right place at the right time. And I think with those two things together, it can definitely make a difference of preventing a lot of the crises or, you know, very severe symptoms that we see. And then I do think that there's been a generational shift where there is more acceptance of mental health. in current generations in comparison to previous generations. And I do think that is a really a good thing. But I do think that when there is a generation gap, that can be a barrier to access to care as well, because there's just, again, that lack of education and awareness and knowledge, really how impactful mental health is for someone's overall health. And so we do a lot of education here. So I work with a lot of patients who their grandparents or great-grandparents are their guardian. And a lot of the work that we do is that education and that awareness of, you know, mental health and these symptoms being a real thing and not being that the child is acting out on purpose, or that the child is just wants to be a bad child, but really trying to think about what is the uncovering underlying reason for why, you know, we are seeing the externalizing behaviors. I do think that awareness is a big, huge piece of it. And I think that the generations, more recent generations, have been a lot more accepting of it.
I believe I've mentioned it on the show multiple times, but I certainly struggle with anxiety and depression as a child. I still do, but I didn't know what it was when I was in, you know, I was that age, and my parents didn't either. So I talk a lot about when I teach those courses that, you know, my parents didn't have, I didn't have the vocabulary to teach my parents what was going on with me, and they didn't know what was going on with me. So I was fortunate I got through it, but that's one thing. I just want to make sure the people around me are educated to recognize those signs and symptoms and know what they're dealing with. So I definitely agree that generational gap is something that I see getting better, but not as fast as I would like. Mm-hmm. So I want to be very respectful of your time. And, you know, we knew we were going to talk today, so I'm hoping that you thought about maybe some of the things that we might talk about. Is there anything that you were hoping you would get a chance to share, but I didn't ask a question that would let you share it? An anecdote, a story, a resource, just really anything that you're like, man, I really hope this comes up. And it didn't. So just pretend I asked you the right question, then you can share with me whatever you would like.
One of the things that we did not really touch on yet is adverse childhood experiences, ACEs.
Okay.
What we do see is that in marginalized communities and minorities in the Black community is that ACEs are typically higher. So that's looking at trauma, for example, community trauma, you know, shootings in the neighborhood, gang violence, domestic violence, abuse, neglect, poverty. So taking into account all of those traumatic experiences and how they can impact a child's mental health. But not only that, we have studies that also show that it impacts their medical, physical health, like obesity, diabetes, and other medical conditions. And so I think when we're thinking about the minority mental health and how it is unique, we're also considering the ACEs, the adverse childhood experiences, and how that can increase their risk for mental health care challenges. It can also create barriers to them being able to seek the treatment that is needed. And so I think when I think about why the rates of suicide are increasing in Blacks, I'm thinking about, well, they're having the trauma, they're not having the resources, and there's not really that utilization of care there. And then there's the historical context of mistrust, intergenerational trauma, a lot of, we've all been through this, we just have to get through it, and less of, you know, more of making excuses for why it's okay. I've been through it, so you're just going to have to go through it. Less of seeing it as a true mental health challenge or problem. Mm. And so I do think that that plays also a huge, huge role into what we're seeing when we're thinking about minority mental health.
So one of the things that I've realized about myself is that sometimes I don't want to be a burden to like my family. So like if I feel like mm-hmm. I'm starting to have anxiety or if I feel like I'm slipping into depression, I want to keep it to myself because I don't want to burden them.
Yes. And we see that a lot with teenagers too. And even kids as young as the youngest I work with here in this setting is 10. But I hear that quite often where kids will say, I don't want to worry my mom or my, you know, especially minority children. I see it in all races, but what I hear a lot with my minority children is my mom's got so much on her plate. She's a single parent. She has 3 jobs. She has to take a bus to get me here. She doesn't, you know, it's like mom is just trying to keep a roof over our head. Right. She's trying to survive. And here I am with these issues. And there's a lot of guilt about that. And so because of that, you know, we do see a lot of times where the teenager will minimize their own symptoms or they will say, no, I'm not going through that anymore. Or they will quickly get better. And there's really not much to account for why the teenager felt better in one day. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, thinking about them not wanting to be a burden because of the socioeconomic barriers that are playing a role. And I see, too, a lot with my minority youth, a lot of children are, I don't know if adultized is a correct word, but they are quickly having to grow up and play a little adult role in the household because there is only one parent or one guardian. And so, especially with the older child, is parenting the other children and having to have that responsibility when they don't have the emotional or cognitive capacity to be able to do so. And so I work a lot with, I actually just had a patient a week ago who she was 11 and her brother was 14, but he was autistic. And her mother was a single mom and she worked Monday through Friday, 5 a.m. to 6 p.m. This 11-year-old came to us with suicidal thoughts. And mom can't provide supervision for her at home every single day. In fact, the 11-year-old was watching the 14-year-old autistic brother while mom was at work. And she's doing homeschooling. So she's in charge of figuring out her own school, her own education, and taking care of her brother. And, you know, lots of trauma in our neighborhood. I remember there was a shooting with a neighbor, and, you know, I'm trying to talk to her about coping skills and how to improve her mental health, but she's, you know, really in survival mode. Mm. So it's just really, really difficult, but I do think we've seen some improvement in awareness and improvement in acceptance. And I do think that is making a huge difference.
So again, very limited experience and exposure, but it seems like there's a lot of similarity in the types of challenges that people face across all their communities. But then you have these other factors that exacerbate the likely outcomes. So, you know,
yes,
that could be any kid, but this particular child's in a home with one parent and an autistic brother. Someone else in a very similar situation, but they have 2 parents, they have more money, they have more free time, it would be easier for them to get the help they would need.
Right. And then there's a fear of, well, if I tell the doctors and the providers that my 11-year-old is watching my 14-year-old autistic brother, will they call CPS on me?
Yep.
And then now I have a whole nother problem on my hands. Yeah. So it's almost like, let me keep everything quiet and hush, hush. And we need to just keep figuring this out ourselves and not look for help. Mm-hmm. Because the more that we try to involve those systems, the more burdensome those right. systems can become.
Getting help almost could make it, in their mind, make it worse.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah, I wish we had that magic wand and we could fix that together, but unfortunately we don't. At least not yet anyways,
right.
working on it. Well, Dr. Barry, thank you so much for being here. I hate to leave on such a dour note. Do we have something really positive we could share right here before we go, like a success story you've had or just something you're excited about in the field?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I think that what's exciting is that our research that we're doing and also just the attention that we are seeing to wanting to improve outcomes in minority communities. And there are just so many more opportunities that I've seen from, like, just thinking about when I started here as a resident up until now. There are so many more financial backing and opportunities for trying to look into improving mental health care in the minority communities. And that to me is very exciting, because it means that, you know, the more that we're able to put the resources into studying and researching, you know, these challenges, I think the more that we're going to actually be able to help kids. And I do see many success stories here in the partial program with kids. I see, for example, I have a young lady right now in the program whose mom brought her into our program for having homicidal ideation and having these irritable outbursts whenever mom would bring someone over to the house, like a date. And she has not been in in-person schooling for 3 years since 2020. She never went back to in-person schooling after COVID. She has significant amount of trauma, but my first day working with her, she opened up and shared some of her struggles, some of her challenges, but we were able to really get to a place where she had some hope for things getting better. And I think seeing that connection, human connection in person, and having someone to talk to, and having a provider that looks like you and can offer you guidance, I think is a big, big deal. And so I've had many stories. I have many stories of working with young people where you do see them get better and you see that positive outcome. You see that their families want their child to get better and they're putting in the effort and they're motivated. And that's why, one of the things of why I do what I do, because to me that's very fulfilling to see a patient come in starting off pretty depressed and down and being able to be motivated to put in some work and have some hope towards the end.
As we bring this week's episode to a close, I want to once again say thank you to Dr. Barry for joining me today and sharing a wealth of knowledge and her experiences as a healthcare provider, particularly with minority patients. I hope you've enjoyed listening today, and I hope you'll join us again next week when we will have another amazing guest on to chat with. As a reminder, if you are interested in becoming a service member or have any questions about serving, or perhaps your organization would like to become a host site, you will find information and links to follow in our show notes.